This is Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from our newsroom this week. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. No time for a long preamble by me today. Let's get right to it. Kara Lofton was a reporting machine this week, beginning with the story of two state-of-the-art 3D bioprinters from Switzerland, recently acquired by UVA. The printers will eventually print tissues that could be used to treat patients with conditions as diverse as burns, to diabetes, to organ failure.
At the intersection of student classrooms in the main UVA hospital is a door behind which one can find rows of biomedical engineering labs. One is the domain of Dr. Shane Pierce Kotler, the UVA professor instrumental in bringing the two bioprinters to Virginia. These printers are possibly the most advanced bioprinters in the world. There are only four total of this design in the United States. One of the bioprinters is in Pierce Kotler's lab. The other is at Fontaine Research Park in the lab of transplant surgeon and researcher Dr. Kenneth Brayman. Together, the printers cost the university $300,000. A bioprinter is essentially a printer that uses cells instead of ink in its cartridges to print tissues or even organs. An eventual, long-term application could be printing custom-made organs for patients using their own cells. Pierce Kotler explains.
What makes it different is that the resolution that it can print tissues in is much, much finer than the other available printers. So we know that cells are pretty much on the order of 10 microns to 100 microns in size. And so our printer is able to print a few cells next to each other and then move over to another location and print some more cells. So we have just a much finer resolution with this particular version of a bioprinter.
Printing organs has actually been done before. The organs just weren't functional. The printers weren't able to print the capillaries and other vessels small enough to allow proper blood flow. This printer has the technical capability to do that, but it may take a few years before researchers figure out how to implement the concept. Right now, the lead project is learning how to print human islets, spelled ISLETS.
These are clusters of cells that live in the pancreas and are responsible for producing insulin. And so the application here is really treating diabetes or enabling a patient, say, with type 1 diabetes to essentially get a new pancreas that's capable of providing them with the insulin that they need. And so the challenge is to print these clumps or clusters of cells in such a way that they are able to recruit a vascular supply. And when we implant them back into the patient, they're able to survive and do their job of producing insulin for that diabetic patient.
Right now, though, Pierce Kotler and her students are still on the stage of figuring out exactly how the printer works. They practice using Nivea cream lotion and petroleum jelly because the two substances have a similar viscosity to the cells they will use in the future. Corey Marshall is an incoming medical student interning at the lab this summer. He said he spends about 8 hours a day working in the lab. By the end of the summer, he hopes to be able to print muscle tissue that will be implanted into rats. It's research that has been ongoing at UVA for some time in other labs, but was difficult to execute without a bioprinter this precise.
This machine has quite a bit of potential. I mean, I've learned quite a bit already as far as how the printers work, how they lay down material sort of layer by layer to create some pretty elaborate shapes, and the incredible precision with which it can do that.
He showed me several shapes the summer students had designed and printed using the Nivea cream. A shark, a castle, and a collagen basket-type structure that could be used in the future to implant cells into a patient. Designing creative structures is a fun way for students to learn the full capacity of the printer. The printer is also drawing people to UVA who might not be there otherwise, such as a Brazilian exchange student who came to the U.S. just to work with the printer, and researchers from other fields who have approached Pierce Kotler with ideas for collaboration. It's an exciting time, she said, with unique opportunities for both training and interdisciplinary cross-pollination.
Kara also advanced our series called Clean Virginia. In this third installment, we take a look at the effect our dependence on electricity can have on the world around us.
In May, Duke Energy Corporation pleaded guilty to 9 criminal violations of the Clean Water Act. The company was investigated after a massive North Carolina coal ash spill into the Dan River in February of 2014 and now faces $102 million in fines. While the Duke spill doesn't directly affect Central and Western Virginia, the law Duke violated in North Carolina, the Clean Water Act, most definitely does. The Clean Water Act was originally passed in 1972. Although it has been amended several times since then, the Clean Water Act is still the primary federal law governing water pollution in the United States. Lena Pettis is one of the senior Justice Department lawyers who brought the criminal charges against Duke in the 2015 case. Pettis is a Harrisonburg native and has been working on a variety of environmental law cases for the Justice Department since she first started working there in 2004. Pettis says the problem with coal ash is that it contains a plethora of toxic heavy metals that, if leaked into local water sources, can contaminate the drinking water for miles downstream.
The crux of the charges here in the Duke case was once you've discovered a seep or once a seep occurs, what you do when you find it. And so in this case, those seeps had been allowed to flow into these, again, the channels that carry them to the river. If they had come up with some other solution so that that water didn't reach the river, then there would have been no Clean Water Act violation because there has to be an actual discharge of the pollutant to a water of the United States for there to be a violation.
Pettis said the seeps are naturally occurring in unlined coal ash ponds. Water contamination often depends on the geographic locations of the pits themselves and the soil quality of the land around the power plant. Ponds dug in clay-heavy soil don't leak as much as the ones in more porous soil. Last month, I visited 2 plants in Central Virginia. One was in Bremo Bluff, between Charlottesville and Richmond, and is the site of Virginia's oldest coal-fired power plant. In 2014, the Bremo plant was converted to natural gas. The other plant, in Chesterfield County outside of Richmond, is the largest fossil-fueled power station in Virginia. Although Bremo Bluff plant has been converted to natural gas, at least one coal ash pit remains. From the top of the plant, one can see how close the pond, which is simply an open pit of coal ash mixed with water, is to the James River. When these pits aren't lined, it is possible for toxic waste containing arsenic, mercury, and lead, and over a dozen other heavy metals to leak into the groundwater and surrounding rivers at great risk to human health. So I asked Dominion Media Relations rep Dan Genist about the pits. Does Dominion line their ash ponds?
Some of them are, some of them aren't, depending on when they were built.
And is the one here lined? Is the one at Bremo Bluff lined?
Bremo's are not lined.
And neither are the ones at Chesterfield. But the ponds at both locations are being closed entirely as the result of a new set of requirements passed in 2015 by the Environmental Protection Agency. The regulations were passed, in part, because of the massive 2014 spill from Duke. Dominion has 3 years to close all their ash ponds and switch them to dry ash landfill, a process they have already started. Moving from a wet pond to a dry landfill should prevent the kind of massive water contamination seen in North Carolina last year. 45 years ago, national waterways were so polluted that if you fell into the Potomac, you'd need to get a tetanus shot. But that isn't the case anymore. The laws, such as the Clean Water Act and the 2015 coal residuals regulations, are working. It's just the work isn't done yet. As the Duke spill has so painfully illustrated, we have a long way to go until our waterways truly are clean and the laws governing major sources of pollution are well followed.
Kara also had time to sit in, or maybe hover in, on a new kind of yoga, taking it beyond the sticky mats and into aerial hammocks at Charlottesville's new aerial fitness studio called Dream Flight Virginia.
Bend the elbows and just bring the hands to prayer right at the forehead.
While it's often called aerial yoga, to say anti-gravity fitness is purely yoga in hammocks is a bit of a misnomer. More accurately, anti-gravity fitness combines
different yoga techniques combined with dance, calisthenics, Pilates. So it's so many different things. It's actually become kind of its new form of fitness in that sense.
That was Lainey Gratz, owner of Dream Flight Virginia. When she was in her teens, Gratz injured her back in a horseback riding accident. She was able to manage her chronic pain through floor yoga, but was never quite able to get into the inversions, such as headstands, that can really help with spinal decompression. Then she tried aerial fitness.
Pretty quickly, within a few classes, I was able to turn around that momentum of pain that was chronic, really, for years. And so really lengthening the spine alignment is huge.
While aerial fitness does require some core strength, Gratz said it is an exercise that is accessible to anyone because the hammock, which is made of parachute silk and looks like the kind of hammock one might have on a back porch somewhere, acts as a support and stabilizer for traditional yoga postures such as the Warrior Series, Downward Facing Dog, and Mountain Pose.
It has been amazing. I at first was kind of, you know, we're going to be going upside down and swinging around in this hammock, but it is just the most enlightening, the most soothing, the most I've ever stretched. My body was able to do things I haven't been able to do for quite a while.
That's student Marina Lamb, who is 55 and a regular practitioner of Bikram yoga. She said as she gets older, she keeps looking for different activities that don't aggravate her arthritis.
Sometimes in yoga, there are poses you're going to go into and you're going to go, oh, this does not feel so good. It is beneficial, but it doesn't feel so good getting into it. In aerial yoga, you don't have the pain issue. It just feels wonderful.
Gratz said, like yoga, aerial fitness combines physical fitness with mindfulness training.
There's the whole concept and importance of mindfulness in this practice, really learning to come to presence while you're working on each pose and learning how to take that with you outside of class as well.
Dreamflight Virginia has been open since April and meets at the Seminar Center in the Berkmar Shopping Center in Charlottesville.
And somehow Ms. Lofton also got the lowdown on new park plans in Harrisonburg, the first steps of which were approved by Harrisonburg City Council on Tuesday.
The plan calls for developing a park in downtown Harrisonburg that would include a new children's play area, a large promenade, and an expanded farmers market. All pieces emphasize an increase in green space. The full master plan, designed by renowned landscape architect Ken Smith in partnership with the Plan Our Park Committee, was presented for the first time in its entirety to City Council Tuesday night. The council voted to accept the plan to authorize city administrators to work with the Plan Our Park Committee to determine the next steps for moving forward and to request city staff to consider including the plan in the 2016-2017 Harrisonburg Capital Improvement Program. While community support for the project has been strong, no money has been raised for actually building the park, and a potential start date for construction may be several years in the future. Josie Showalter is the manager of the Harrisonburg Farmers Market.
We certainly have a vested interest in the park happening and all the ways that it will impact the community and the farmers market. We're really excited about that.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
We can't let Kara have all the fun. Andrew Jenner tackled a story much in Virginia news this week. Dominion Power's lawsuits against 27 landowners in Virginia, with more to come. Because those landowners have so far refused surveyors for the proposed Atlantic Coast Pipeline under their properties.
When Shahir Kasim Adams and his wife Nancy were looking for a new place to call home 7 or 8 years ago, they ended up in Nelson County.
We fell in love with the area because it's so close to Charlottesville, and at the same time, it's very, very secluded and very pristine. A lot of the area shares our values, where people have been great stewards of the country, of the farms around there. So we felt that we really enjoyed that and belonged.
But now they have a problem. One potential route for the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, which Dominion wants to build to transport natural gas, crosses the Kasim Adams' driveway. They don't want the pipeline there. They don't even want surveyors coming to begin planning a route. By state law, though, utilities don't need landowner permission for surveys like this. And so the Kasim Adamses are getting sued.
We've sent two letters out as required by the law, and we're asking landowners who continue to deny us permission if they would reconsider allowing us to survey. But unfortunately, some continue to steadfastly deny us, and that's why we're going to court.
Dominion spokesman Frank Mack says that it's in landowners' best interest to cooperate with the surveys.
They know their property better than anybody else. They can make us aware of a wetland or a stream, a family cemetery, even a 200-year-old oak tree that they would prefer that we preserve. But we can't find the best route with the least environmental impact until we actually survey, and that's why having permission from the landowners is critical.
That view would be so much more credible if they started the conversation that way and then said, hey, we want to engage in finding a path through this. There's nothing civil about taking away someone's property. It's a whole lot more egregious to take away someone's property and couch it in the terms of, well, I'm being reasonable, and why don't you just talk to me about it? That seems like a conversation between a powerful person and a less powerful person, not between neighbors.
So far, Dominion has sued 27 landowners in Virginia, most of them in Nelson County. Max says the company plans to take similar action against up to 100 more people in the state.
I think in any infrastructure project today, you almost expect to have opposition. So that's not a surprise. We're still on schedule. We're planning on filing our preferred route with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission later this summer.
The Kasem Adams' case will be heard in circuit court in several weeks. Their lawyers will argue on some technicalities of state law that Dominion doesn't actually have the right it thinks it does to survey their property.
I believe that the circuit court will rule in our favor, but more importantly, they will see it for what it is. The first step towards grabbing a hold of people's dreams, their homes, their property, without any consideration towards what it is that could be an alternative, which is what they're required to do. They're required to look for alternatives before they settle on taking away or stealing people's properties.
In the meantime, two cases now in federal court are challenging the state law Dominion wants to enforce against people like Kasem Adams. Both lawsuits were brought by pipeline opponents, and they were argued in February in Harrisonburg. Nancy Sorrells, a former Augusta County supervisor active in several groups opposing the pipeline, says a joint ruling on these cases is expected soon.
We're not overly optimistic of what the outcome is going to be, but even if the judge says, no, they can go ahead and survey, it's constitutional, it'll be appealed. Now, I think if the judge says it's not constitutional, Dominion will appeal it. So either way, we're far from over on the decision.
In other words, expect to be hearing a lot more about this. Dominion plans to start construction next year, but at the same time...
You've got a lot of people that have said, you're not coming on my property, you know, no way, no how. I've never seen anything that has galvanized people and brought people together from across all spectrums of the political process. And I won't say that 100% of people that are opposed to the pipeline, but that's a pretty large number, and I've never seen anything like it in a local issue, and I've seen a lot of local issues.
For WMRA News, I'm Andrew Jenner.
Here's something we've been working on for a while here at WMRA, but I'll let the two guys who have done the heavy lifting speak for themselves.
I'm Brent Finnegan.
And I'm Andrew Jenner. Today, we're talking about mountain lions in Virginia.
When I was in high school here in Rockingham County, I heard a lot about mountain lions, but I never saw one myself.
I haven't either. But we found a guy named Larry Carpenter who has. And earlier this year, he took us to Home Quarry, west of Harrisonburg, to the very spot he saw them.
When I was here in the fall of 78, I was hunting squirrels with a friend and had sat down by a tree on a small ridge to wait for a squirrel to show up. And a squirrel didn't, but these two cats did. Obviously, a cougar, there's nothing else like them when you see them. People talk about long-tailed dogs and big bobcats and stuff, but there is no way.
Larry got a great look at these, and since he was hunting, he was even able to watch them through his rifle scope.
Here's what's weird, though. The official scientific consensus is that mountain lions went extinct in Virginia more than a century ago.
This is Bill McShay. I work for the Smithsonian Institution. I'm a wildlife ecologist. I'm based in Front Royal, Virginia.
How many mountain lions have you seen in Virginia?
None. Not only haven't I seen any with my eyes, but I run a very extensive camera trapping program where we now have, in the last 5 years, maybe 3 million images of wildlife from all the protected areas in the region, and there's no mountain lion pictures anywhere among the 3 million.
Biologists like Bill get lots of reports from people who say they've seen them, and some, like Larry's, are pretty believable.
But at the same time, there's really hardly any tangible evidence that mountain lions are here. Larry's story, after all, is just a story.
I am skeptical. I mean, I've read an awful lot of scientific papers, and I think skepticism is the bottom line.
Chris Bolgiano lives in Folks Run, and she edited a book about mountain lions in the East.
But I can be convinced. I mean, you know, I'm not closed-minded. I do think there are a few out there at any given time in the Appalachian Mountains. Whether they're native eastern cougars, whether they're feral escaped, or whether they have moved in from the western states, which is possible, I don't know.
So some mountain lions are kept in captivity, and a few of these escape or get let go. And every now and then, one from out west, where they definitely live, wanders way far east. One actually got hit on the road in Connecticut a few years ago.
All this sort of messes with the definition of exist. Maybe it's like people on the moon. You wouldn't say people exist on the moon, but people have been to the moon.
You know that's not true, right?
That'll be our next mystery to investigate. But seriously here.
This reminds me of Schrödinger's cat. Have you ever heard of it?
No?
It's a thought experiment from quantum physics. And long story short, there's this cat that ends up being alive and dead at the same time. Could mountain lions exist and not exist at the same time?
Let's bring in Christian Early. He was a philosophy professor of mine at Eastern Mennonite University, and he loves to talk about this kind of stuff.
You cannot rule out the possibility that the world that we see is much tamer than the world that there really is. And that's the bothersome thing about Schrödinger's cat. He wanted to show that multiple realities were really absurd, but what he managed to do instead was to insert in everyone this uneasiness that possibly the world is actually much more strange than we know.
One reason people are so fascinated with mountain lions is because they can make you vaguely uneasy. They're giant cats, they're silent, and there might be one right behind you.
And doing a radio story about the maybe or maybe not living in Virginia now has taken us down this path where I'm kind of uneasy about reality itself. I keep thinking back to that image of Larry watching the mountain lions through the scope of his rifle.
Yeah, there's a part of me that kind of wishes that he had shot one of them, just so there could be proof.
It's funny, because if he'd done that, he could have proven that they existed, but in a way, they wouldn't have existed any more than after that, right?
Yeah, but instead he just watched them wander off to who knows where.
You can find the full version of Schrödinger's Cougar at WMRA.org.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our coverage possible, comes from Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus, Janet Trentner, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, Joy Loving, Jim and Pam Huggins, and an anonymous donor.